The central banks are not government agencies. They're private clearinghouses for private banks with government support. And if governments withdrew their support on these things, like the Federal Reserve, you'd find that it's sitting there with piles of bad debt, junk bonds, unsustainable, unpayable corporate and government debt. So that's what has to be done. The governments have to cut these central banks loose and establish a national bank in which credit is directly directed into the economy. You know, when we've done this in the past, this is the Hamiltonian system. This is what Lincoln did to rebuild the country during the Civil War. This is what John Kennedy was talking about when he brought back treasury bills. Now, virtually every time someone's done that, the three people I mentioned, Hamilton, Lincoln, and Kennedy, were all assassinated. That's not a coincidence, because messing with the private central banks is the greatest challenge you can present to these corrupt swindlers. And they'll do anything, including assassination, including launching riots and chaos in cities, false flags, proxy wars, and real wars to stop the move away from the central banking model.
Hi, and welcome to the X22 Report Spotlight. Today we have a returning guest, Harley Schlanger. Harley is a historian, a national spokesman. He's been covering the financial industry since the 80s for LaRouche Pack. That's LaRouchePack.com. And I am very happy to have him back on the X22 Report Spotlight. Harley, welcome back to the Spotlight.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Let's start off with what is happening here in the United States with the Mueller investigation, because we know the IG report came out. Mueller's still doing his investigation, and I just want you to bring us up to date on where you think the Mueller investigation is actually going. Is it moving in a positive direction, or is it just dead and it can't go anywhere?
Well, he's desperate, and the people who want to stop Trump are desperate. They've turned up nothing of substance. They have what are called process indictments on lying to the FBI and money laundering charges, things of that sort. I mean, I think his desperation was made clear by his jailing of Paul Manafort, by revoking Manafort's bail, because with nothing really to hang on Trump, he's going to try and turn Manafort. And when you put someone 68, 69 years old in a prison cell, someone who's accustomed to living pretty well, it's a sign that you're really trying to break them. But I don't think it's going to work. I think Manafort knows if he goes to trial, he's got a good chance of beating the charges, even in the home district, the home court advantage that Mueller would have in Alexandria, Virginia. So to answer your question, I think the case is as flimsy as ever, but it's not going to stop. You see the media continuing to come up with stuff. They're speculating now as much, you know, almost daily on whether Roger Stone is a Kremlin insider. You know, anyone who's still alive from the 70s who knows anything about Roger Stone, the idea that this guy who was with Nixon, who was with Reagan, that this guy would be an insider in the Kremlin would have their head examined. But that's how desperate Mueller is. Now, the other side, which you mentioned, is the blowback against the FBI and the Justice Department. And this is really serious. The Peter Strzok case, the top or number two counterintelligence guy at the FBI, who was John Brennan's liaison between the FBI and the CIA, Strzok's connection to Christopher Steele and the whole British side of this, all of this is coming out. The role of another FBI informant, this guy Greenberg, who spent 10 years in prison in Russia, or actually it may not have been Russia, it may have been somewhere else. But then he shows up as an FBI informant who is put in contact with Roger Stone after the Halper entrapment attempt. These are all FBI sting operations. And if they come to trial, there's a really good chance that even with corrupt judges, that people will get off. And, you know, I think it's really important that this dirt on the FBI, the DOJ, the CIA, the so-called deep state, and their British connection keeps coming out, because this is the crux of the problem. And what we can talk about in the program today is that you have a collapse underway in the Western financial system. You have a breakaway that's consolidating in Asia. And now you have a group of what you might call rogue European nations that are challenging the EU. And if Trump works with Asia, with China, Japan, South Korea, and Russia, as he did with the Kim Jong-un meeting, if he works with Asia on economics, on development policy, then Europe is either going to fall off the map, or they're going to have to come along also, in which case the old transatlantic system is dead. And all I can say to that is good riddance.
So do you think Trump is actually headed in that direction where he's going to be working with Xi Jinping? Because now they have Kim Jong-un on board. Kim Jong-un is meeting with Putin. They have, you know, Trump meeting with Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un meeting with Xi Jinping. Do you think this is all part of the One Belt, One Road, the next economic system where they're, you know, building this from the relationships with each other on the Asian front? And then, of course, you mentioned Europe. We have Europe, which is just hanging on right now. And there are certain nations, like you said, that are rebelling. Is that the direction that we're headed in?
Well, I think the way to look at it is that what Obama tried to do as president, or the people who controlled Obama with the so-called Asia pivot, was an attempt to head off the emergence of a potential new system. Now, people who live in the United States are constantly bombarded with stories that China's an enemy, China's a problem. And I'm a little bit worried about Trump pushing this trade war question, because the Chinese are willing to work with him. And I hope that we pull back from that. But the important thing here is that the Chinese need the United States as a market, a trade partner, and as a backup for the economic programs they're undertaking. Now, we need China because, right, we depend on China for a lot of our manufactured goods, but also China is a potentially enormous market for American firms such as Boeing, Caterpillar, and others that could work with China on the new Silk Road or the Belt and Road policy. But the test of this was North Korea, and Trump, in his first meeting with Xi Jinping, set in motion a collaboration to bring North Korea to the table. And one of the key things that this involves, which was in that 4-minute video that the U.S. media tried to make fun of, but was really an important contribution to the discussion, is that we're offering North Korea, Trump is offering North Korea, and Xi Jinping is offering North Korea a connection to the Belt and Road Initiative, so that there are three pathways going through North Korea connecting Russia, Japan, South Korea, and China to Western Europe on the Belt and Road, the high-speed rail system. So this is an offer you can't refuse, you might say, if you're a North Korean president. So this was put together as a package. Instead of Obama's policy of excluding China and threatening war in the South China Sea, trying to stare down China on trade, what happened is that Trump made a series of initiatives with Xi Jinping, and they hit it off. The Russians are involved in this. While the G7 summit was collapsing in Canada, and for good reason, maybe it's going to become the G4 soon. But while that was collapsing, there was a conference called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that took place in China with Xi Jinping, with President Putin, with Modi of India, the President of Pakistan, the President of Afghanistan, many of the countries of the Eurasian Economic Union met and mapped out an extensive series of economic plans. Now, if the Chinese continue in this direction, with the possibility of American support, then the old speculative dollar system gets thrown out the window. Not the dollar, but the system which says that the only way to make money is speculation, higher and higher risk, I win, you lose. Instead, that could be replaced by what the Chinese call a win-win solution, mutual benefit. And I think Trump is very much orienting in this direction. I think his tough stand on trade with China is that he is convinced that unless you do something about the trade deficit with China, which is quite huge and in which the Chinese have taken advantage of the United States, China's going to have to give. They're going to have to do some concessions. But both of us need each other. And it's certainly a better alternative than going to war in the South China Sea or going to war with Russia over Ukraine.
Now, since Trump is pushing forward these tariffs on China, you know, you see it all over the corporate media. They're saying, oh, trade wars leads to currency war, leads to war. Do you think this is what he's trying to do, bring us to war?
No, not at all. I don't think he wants to bring us to war. I think that's why he wants to talk to China, to Kim Jong-un, to Putin. It's in fact the people who are saying this would lead to war who are the ones pushing for war. The ones who use the Skripal poisoning hoax, the Duma Syria chemical weapons false flag, they're the ones who are against Trump and pushing for war. I think either Trump is playing a very tough negotiating game with Xi Jinping, which is not advisable, or some of the people like Lighthizer and Peter Navarro are running a little bit wild right now. And I think this has to be resolved in a decent negotiation. But the other thing, Dave, that's going on is that those aspects of the financial crisis that you and I have been discussing over the last couple of years, the buildup of corporate debt, of derivative debt, the unsustainable debt of countries like Italy and the United Kingdom, these are all coming to a head. And the media is blaming the collapse of the stock market the last few days and the up and down ride of the dollar on the trade talk. I think that's nonsense. I think the trade thing will be worked out. But what they have to do is they have to work it out because you'd better deal with this overhang of unsustainable debt because otherwise it's going to come crashing down. Now, one really interesting aspect of the G7 conference was that Trump hit it off with the new prime minister of Italy, Conte. Conte sided with Trump on bringing Russia back into the G, make it the G8 again. But he also said he wants to lift the sanctions on Russia. And he also, his government, his new government, is pursuing a policy of Glass-Steagall. That's in their program. A separation of investment banks from commercial banks so that the investment banks will be forced to eat their losses instead of getting bailed out by the European Central Bank. Now, if that were to happen, that would mean that Italian banks and the Italian government could channel funds into real economic development, into the real economy. And Trump and Conte had a short discussion, and Trump was very enthusiastic about it. And so I think that his hitting it off with Conte, his inviting Conte to come to Washington is quite significant. So there are a number of things that people in the U.S. don't see that are moving parts. What we do see, and I just want to call attention to this, is that the Republicans in Congress are not pro-Trump. They're using free trade to try and sabotage what Trump is doing overall because The idea of tariffs in themselves are not bad. Protecting American industry is not bad. But some of it is not thought through fully, I would say. But Republicans oppose the tariffs completely. They're for total free trade. They're for the destruction of American industry. They want cheap labor, whether it's from the United States or from overseas. And so you see people like Marco Rubio siding with Chuck Schumer in attacking what Trump is doing with Kim Jong-un. So you have this Republican, Democratic, neocon, neoliberal alliance against Trump. And that's part of the reason, I think, that the Russiagate scandal has not been ended, because there are too many Republicans in Congress who are afraid of Trump for the same reason that the Democrats are. That is, that he's against Wall Street, he's against these funny money policies, and their livelihood depends on those funny money policies.
Yeah, those two parties, I do believe that they're one and the same. They're almost on the same exact agenda, where Trump is on a completely different agenda, and they don't like this whatsoever. And I think this is why even Republicans have been trying to push Trump out since the beginning, that they haven't let up. But you did mention something with Europe and Italy. I know the Italians now, they're following the policy of Italy first, just like America, where it's America first. Merkel, on the other hand, she is having a difficult time in Germany with the refugees coming into the country, and there's a backlash there. And I know Italy says they're not going to be accepting any more immigrants coming into the country right now. Do you see this happening all throughout Europe?
It's very interesting what's happening, and you have to go back a few weeks to Putin's trip to Vienna, where the new Austrian government, which is called a center-right coalition. I mean, these terminologies are really useless. It's an Austrian nationalist coalition of the Freedom Party with the old Conservative Party. But what are they calling for? They're calling for an end to sanctions on Russia. They're joining with Italy, saying the European Union policy on refugees doesn't exist, and you need to have a policy that protects national interests. And the coalition partner of Merkel, the Christian Social Union, which is part of the Christian Democratic Party, it's Bavaria, Munich, southern Germany, they're siding with Austria and Italy. Now, what happened in Italy is interesting, because the majority of the vote in the last election went to the Grillo Party, which is sort of a kind of crazy amalgam, mishmash. But the second largest vote getter was the Lega, which used to be a northern separatist party, but now has rebranded itself as an economic nationalist party, pro-Glass-Steagall, anti-Euro. They're saying if the European Central Bank and the European Union continues to withhold credit to Italian industry and won't allow the Italian government to generate credit, then they'll force them to have a referendum on the euro, which at this point would probably win for an Italian exit. So the new government in Italy is taking a hard line against the crazy bankers of Brussels, Frankfurt, and London. Now, the new wrinkle is that Seehofer, who's the head of the Christian Social Union, Merkel's partner, had a phone conversation with the Italians and with the Austrians, and they called for a common policy. Now, they're being attacked as racist, anti-immigrant, hardcore genocidalists, basically. But here's what happened. A boat that was coming to Italy, in violation of the various agreements that were made, the Italians turned it back. Now, the Spanish government took the refugees from that boat, but the French attacked the Italians. So the Italians said, well, why are you attacking us? You don't take any immigrants. And so the Italians said, we need a European policy. So Merkel jumped in and said the European policy should be to accept a certain number of immigrants, and the ones we don't accept, we'll put in detention camps in North Africa. Now, they're basically talking, and for Germans, this is quite shocking. They're talking about concentration camps for African refugees. Now, the Italians, instead of embracing that, what did they say? They said, look, why don't we work with China to invest in building the countries of North Africa up? Why don't we build some infrastructure there, some water projects like Gaddafi was doing, some rail, some power plants? And so instead of being racists against the Africans and the Arabs in North Africa, what the Italians are saying is, let's have Europe work with the Chinese to develop these countries so that people won't leave Africa. They won't risk dying of thirst in the Sahara or drowning in the Mediterranean, but they can live in their own countries. The EU and Merkel are opposed to that. So Merkel's in a corner right now. Her coalition government, as of this moment, is hanging by a thread. She's trying to work out another compromise. I think, like a cat that's already seen its nine lives gone, Merkel is on a very short half-life.
Do you think that she's going to survive this?
Well, it's going to be very difficult because there are two things. First of all, she will probably work out a compromise, because if there is no compromise and the CSU breaks, then her government coalition collapses. There's no alternative coalition that could come in, so there'll be new elections. And who will gain in those new elections? Probably the AfD, the so-called extreme right party. So either the major parties of Europe shift away from free trade, Brussels, euro, and by that I also mean austerity, because the European Central Bank is demanding debt be paid by cutting spending in infrastructure, in job training, and other programs that are good and useful. So they're all unpopular. That's why all the political parties in Europe are collapsing, the major political parties, just like the Democrats and Republicans are becoming more unpopular in the United States. So either Merkel or someone is going to have to come up with an economic nationalist policy for Germany, or the European Union is going to break apart. And this is like a slow train wreck. You know, sitting here in Berlin, I was just at a conference today, and people were putting forward all kinds of scenarios. And I said, look, none of these scenarios will work because they're based on the same assumptions that you've had for the last 5 years. And everyone got very glum and said, yeah, that's true, but we have no option. And I said, sure, you have an option. Let's create prosperity. Let's junk the policies of bailout. Let's junk the speculation. Stop having people suffer so that the banks get their derivatives bailed out. Instead, let's generate national credit into the real economy, so that if you're going to take on new debt, let's have it go towards something that will increase the value added to the productive process so you can pay off the debt, as opposed to borrowing to create new debt to pay off old debt. And I think that's what the Chinese have tried to do to take the hot air out of their bubble. And that's a good policy. Well, will we do it in the United States? Will they do it in Europe? That's the $64 million question.
But shouldn't we go to the root of the problem? I mean, shouldn't all the countries, I mean, look at this and say, you know something, maybe we should get rid of the central banking system, the private Western central banking system. I mean, that because if we pay down the debt or things like that, we're just going to end up with debt again. I mean, we're just going to go through the same exact thing.
Well, it's if you give a cocaine addict more money, what's he going to do with it? He's going to buy more cocaine. The banking system is based on it's like a heroin addict. The more money it gets, the more it consumes. The worse the ability is to ever pay it back. Now, that is a problem of the central banks, because the central banks are not government agencies. They're private, they're clearinghouses for private banks with government support. And if governments withdrew their support on these things, like the Federal Reserve, you'd find that it's sitting there with piles of bad debt, junk bonds, unsustainable, unpayable corporate and government debt. So that's what has to be done. The governments have to cut these central banks loose and establish a national bank in which credit is directly directed into the economy through the private banking system, so that private bankers can decide who they're going to make loans to. And you know, when we've done this in the past, this is the Hamiltonian system. This is what Lincoln did to rebuild the country during the Civil War. This is what John Kennedy was talking about when he brought back treasury bills. Now, virtually every time someone's done that, the three people I mentioned, Hamilton, Lincoln, and Kennedy, were all assassinated. That's not a coincidence, because messing with the private central banks is the greatest challenge you can present to these corrupt swindlers. And they'll do anything, including assassination, including launching riots and chaos in cities, false flags, proxy wars, and real wars to stop the move away from the central banking model. But that's what we have to do. We have to break with that model and go back to a productive-oriented real economy.
I think there was one person that I know of, Andrew Jackson, who actually got rid of the central bank. I think they did attempt to assassinate him, but it failed. But in the end, he did get rid of the central bank.
Well, that's a slightly different case, because the problem is that it generated a crash in the economy, because what Jackson did by getting rid of the Bank of the United States is that he opened the door for private banks to become behemoths. So you don't need a central bank, but the function of a national bank is basically treasury credit in the name of the United States, but credit that will be used for production as opposed to handed out to bankers to sell debt and make money on it. I mean, it's the simple distinction is productive credit versus funny money. And, you know, we can debate what is productive credit. That's a good debate to have. That'd be very useful for the Congress to take up and for the major newspapers to take up. Instead, they start from the standpoint that the current free trade globalized system is the only option. And we have to do everything possible to defend it, including if it means killing people with austerity to pay off the debt that's owed, that these banks say is owed to them. So the key thing is the shift from the present model of central banking to a policy which ensures that entrepreneurs, businesses, industrialists, farmers can get credit to produce. If you don't have that, you don't have an economy.
Now, I wanted to switch over to this Trump-Putin summit, because we know they had the G7. Actually, they called it like the G6 plus one. Russia was not included. And I think the plus one was the U.S. And Trump has been talking about having Russia come back into the fold to make it the G8 once again. Now, we know the corporate media does not want Trump and Putin to meet. They do not like this whatsoever, because their narrative is that Russia's evil, Putin's evil, and they should never meet because we should be going to war with them.
Trump is evil also. That's the other part of that.
Yeah. Two evil people, you know, meeting, that's going to start a war. Why do you think right now they decided that this is a good time to meet?
I think because Trump sees the Russiagate starting to collapse. But the whole point of Russiagate, these baseless, false charges that Putin interfered in the U.S. election, that Trump colluded with Putin, those charges were made up completely by people like John Brennan and his collaborators in the United Kingdom, like Hannigan from the GCHQ, like Sir Richard Dearlove from MI6, Christopher Steele. And in this, you had the Clinton campaign working with the Obama intelligence community, Brennan and Clapper, working with British intelligence to create a whole series of lies about Russian interference. Why? Because during the campaign, Trump said he wants to meet with Putin. He wants to work with Putin. He wants to work with Putin against terrorism. Well, draw the conclusion. Why would they be concerned if Russia and the United States worked against terrorism? Because the terrorists were a product of that British-American cooperation. ISIS and Al-Qaeda were the U.S., British, Saudi, Israeli coordination. And Trump, initially when he came in, said he was going to break that. No more regime change wars. So that's why they were running Russiagate. Now, with Russiagate faltering and going nowhere except for indictments on non-Russia-related topics, I think Trump now feels that he's somewhat free to do what he wanted to do. And I think the meeting with Kim Jong-un gave him a certain sense of confidence. The Washington Post yesterday said that Trump's advisors are telling him don't meet with Putin, the same advisors who told him not to congratulate Putin on his reelection. So, you know, Dave, I think it's really ironic that these great defenders of democracy in the House, Democrats, Republicans, the neoconservatives, these great defenders of democracy scoff at Putin, who got over 70% of the vote, whereas, you know, Merkel's party was down in the low 30s. Her coalition partner, the Social Democrats, had 16% of the vote. So, you know, who are the real believers in democratic processes? Certainly not the EU and these guardians of U.S. purity who are out to destroy Trump, who, after all, did win the election. So I think he feels a little bit freed now to pursue this. I think he also knows that he and Putin together would make a fairly strong team. And this might be what's necessary to break the back of this British operation in Europe, which keeps the European government subordinated to the Brussels bureaucracy and the European Union.
We do see certain European countries like France, Germany, they are moving closer to Russia. They are dealing with Russia. They don't want the sanctions anymore, of course, because it's hurting their country. So we do see some European countries moving towards China and Russia right now.
But the EU just voted to extend the sanctions. And the EU also is suing the Chinese to try and keep them out of Germany and France, whereas the Italians, the Spanish, the Greeks, the Portuguese, and most of the Eastern Europeans are welcoming the Chinese. And why shouldn't they? The Chinese are saying, we want to invest in your economy. And the Chinese have money. They have banks that would rather invest in physical production than in speculation. And here's one of the ironies of the trade war talk against China. What Lighthizer and Navarro, two of the lead negotiators for the United States, are demanding is that China open up its banking system. Now, the Chinese are going to refuse to do that because they don't want to have a derivative speculation bubble and then a swap bubble on top of that. They don't want that. They were heading in that direction and they stopped it. The Chinese, in effect, have banking separation like Glass-Steagall, so that with all the dollars they have, the treasuries and U.S. dollars, they use that as a base for extending credit for production. And that's why New York bankers, Goldman Sachs, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and others want to get into China. They want to grab the liquidity, just as they did from American firms, just as they've done in the United States. And the Chinese are saying no. So I think what we're going to see on this is, you know, if Trump doesn't learn the lesson, we're going to have a really nasty fight with the Chinese. But I think if Trump and Xi Jinping get together, if Trump and Putin get together, what they'll realize is that we all have the same enemies.
Yeah, I agree with that. We do all have the same enemy. We just have to point the finger at the enemy instead of pointing it at each other. And you mentioned Russia, China, their economy. Now, Russia and China, they've been de-dollarizing. Same thing with India. The African nations are saying that we rather deal in yuan than the dollar. It makes no sense to use the dollar right now. And we see a lot of bilateral trade agreements with China and many different countries. Same thing with Russia. Now, they're continually doing this. And actually, Russia came out and said they're reducing their treasuries because they want to protect their reserves. So do they see that this whole dollar economy is starting to deteriorate and break down very quickly?
Oh, sure. Look, the Russians have a huge amount of gold. The Chinese are buying gold. They're starting to do trade deals for petroleum and natural gas in other currencies. For example, with Iran, if we shut Iran out of the international trade system, China will continue to buy oil from them. They'll just buy it with yuan. So it's not that the dollar system is dead, but that if the dollar system stays as it is, it's dying. It's sick. And the Chinese and the Russians don't want to give up the dollar system to put all the pressure on Russian or the ruble or the yuan. They'd like to see the dollar survive, but they're not going to support it if the dollar is going to remain as a speculative item and if the U.S. continues to use sanctions to cut off trade. So, you know, I don't think we're on an imminent shift from the dollar to the yuan, but we are seeing the end of the supremacy of the London Wall Street control over the world economy. Now, that's a fact Americans have to learn to live with. And we're not the only productive nation in the world anymore. China is productive. The Russians are becoming more productive. Germany, even Italy, has a productive economy. We've outsourced so much of our manufacturing from the United States that we're actually in a much shakier position to defend our currency than the Chinese or the Russians are. So they certainly see that, and they're taking precautions. I don't think they've reached the point yet where they're going to pull the plug on the dollar or say, look, we're the new system. But if we don't wake up, you know, we're going to be watching the high-speed rail of the Eurasian economy take off, and we're going to be watching the taillights blinking on the caboose.
Yeah, I agree. This reminds me of when they, you know, if you go, this is going back many years, I think it's like in the 80s when they told us, you know, the middle class is going to disappear. Fast forward to today, we see that the middle class is disappearing. I think the same thing with the dollar and what's been happening. Eventually, what's going to happen is soon the dollar will disappear, just like the middle class, just like manufacturing in the United States. I mean, there are warning signs all over the place. And, you know, as people continually ignore it and we, you know, let other power structures handle our affairs, they're really not helping the situation. They're actually destroying what we've had. Because if you look back in time, that's what they've done. They destroyed manufacturing. They destroyed the middle class. They destroyed the economy. Everything that they touch, they've destroyed.
Well, they're destroying the youth of this country. The youth of the United States are having their hope taken away. They're having crappy education. They're having social networking replace human communication skills, and then they're being drugged up. And the suicide rate, I mean, when you talk about the dying of the middle class, the 18 to 34-year-old white males have an extremely high drug death rate from drugs. So we're seeing a real collapse of the future for the United States. And the irony is that this character, Donald Trump, who most of the media excoriate and slander and attack, he may be the last hope for restoring America. And, you know, I say that not as someone who's a total believer in Trump, but one who admires the fact that he's fighting against the enemies of our country. And Dave, if there's one point I want to get across, it's that the enemies of this country, of the United States, through the media, through the political parties, they have had their way for the last 40 years, and they've wrecked everything. The fact that they're still in power is a sign that, that too many people who know better, who know that they're incompetent and corrupt and evil, too many people have sat on the sidelines. And we're at a point now where they're vulnerable because Trump did stand up and fight. Is he the perfect leader? Is he the greatest guy in history? Of course not. But he did something that no president has done since John Kennedy was killed, which is stand up and fight against the deep state. And we have to give him support for that. And we have to make sure that that fight continues until we crush the John Brennans and the Clappers and the Obamas and the Susan Rices, the Bush networks. They have to be defeated. Whether they end up in prison or not matters less to me than that their hands are removed from the levers of power in this country.
Harley, thank you very much for being on the X22 Report Spotlight. Once again, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, the best way is to go to LaRouchePack.com for daily updates, videos, and so on. And if people want to get a hold of me and get access to my blog, the best way to do that is to send me an email to my personal email, and I'll get you the connection. And that's harleysch@gmail.com.
Harley, once again, thank you very much for being on the Spotlight. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's good talking with you again, Dave.
You too.